okay with that? Is that helping at all?
Yeah, okay.
Okay.
Thanks very much, and it's great to see the bee crowd here. You have such an active and nice group. Okay. So yeah, I'm going to, starting a little bit late, so I'm going to kind of wing into this, but I'm going to talk about some projects that we have in the lab and also general projects in the community that have attempted to address bee health, but with a slant towards more genetic projects or projects that are using genetic tools to understand both honeybees and also the various biotic threats that come into their lives. And of course, this is one of the dramatic representations of honeybee exodus, as it were, from a hive. And there's been a lot of interest in bees lately, more so than maybe sickle bee, even Eric would remember, because there have been some crises within bee health, and also, of course, a greater awareness of the importance of honeybees to the economy and to agriculture, as well as the environment. One of the sort of buzzword words that reached the forefront now about 8 years ago was colony collapse disorder, which was a syndrome, a renaming, as it were, of a syndrome by which worker bees within a colony leave the scene fairly quickly enough that beekeepers would notice brood remaining in the colony that had to have been provided for by workers that had died in the last couple of weeks or so. So there's this strange syndrome associated with bee losses, and then also a sort of a sense that the bees across the world, and domesticated honeybees at least, were declining, that there were losses that were at higher rates than they had been historically. And that's the loss rate, the yearly sort of colony loss rate for bees certainly is high, and it's not a good situation for beekeeping. That is, commercial beekeepers need to replace colonies lost annually because they need to provide a certain set number of hives for pollination, and of course if they're making any of their economy or if they're living on honey production, they need those hives there. So this loss rate, which is in many cases 30, 40, 50% of the hives each year, is very it's damaging to the beekeeping industry. It doesn't mean that honeybees as a species are disappearing from the face of the earth. Unlike, and there we have to look to maybe other pollinators where there really is a true loss of, a true risk of extinction. Honeybees are holding steady, but it's only because of lots of extra work by the beekeepers and efforts to, and an economy that actually sustains them. And so to reduce those impacts, especially on the beekeeping, beekeepers themselves, we have several options to address these losses, and these are a few of them: controlling known bee diseases and stress better, continuing this sort of a forensic attempt to understand why beehives fail, honeybee hives fail, protecting them from environmental stress or toxins. Pesticides have come into greater awareness because of this. Breeding better bees, of course, and then as a carrot for the thousands and thousands of other species to also look into other pollinators. What our lab is focused on are the first two, and so we're really trying to look at the diseases that bees face, biotic threats from viruses to other arthropods, and to reduce those, either through breeding or especially through management of those threats. And then we do have this undercurrent, especially our lab had this diagnostic service going for decades, really. So we have an undercurrent of research trying to understand new losses of colonies and see if we can trace that to an agent, to a biological agent or another cause. This is harder to read. This is just the sort of post office listing of the most wanted pathogens and parasites of honeybees, from the viruses on the left in two main families of RNA viruses in bees and some unclassified species. Bacteria, some of which cause recognizable disease in bees, fungi, protozoa, and then of course the arthropods, the other, the mites and beetles that are parasites on beehives. The colony level losses were striking both because of the degree of them in some apiaries and also again the way they happen, the way that the beehives lost this sort of mass population of workers in short order without presenting the usual symptoms that we might see with disease or even with an acute pesticide threat. So our group, this is Don Lopez and our lab who ran many of these tests, we were sort of given one charge to take samples from these declining colonies and try to figure out if we could use a genetic screen, a way to post hoc determine what might have been a factor in those losses. And this is the gory truth of it. We went out in the field somewhat, but most of the time we get frozen samples coming in and we mash up 50 or 100 bees and simply forage in those bees for any sign of microbes, especially that were candidates for hurting bee health. And this is one upshot of that, where we used RNA sequencing, so sort of a really unbiased backing off from the knowledge of bee pathology, backing off and saying, let's just look as much as possible and see if anything sticks to the wall as being a cause to this. And a few things were evident in these colonies. They truly did have higher parasite and pathogen loads, higher levels of many of these RNA viruses. And more interestingly, the samples we had from California looked different from the samples from Pennsylvania or Florida or even Texas. And so there's something going on whereby colonies were picking up levels of parasites and pathogens, but the actual species that were at least implicated at this stage of decline, the species were different in each place. So that, at one point, is kind of depressing because it means you don't have a single viable cause of this. But it also pointed to the fact that these bees were getting some sort of greater risk to biological threats. This pattern is replicated. This is a more recent survey from Turkey. Same idea. Different regions had parasites and pathogens at higher levels in declining colonies, but the actual species were not the same across these regions. Again, it doesn't make sense, per se, as a sweep of a species through a population, which is what many of us had kind of put our chips on, is that there was a new virus, a new trait that was coming to the population. If that's happening, it's not evident from sort of these survey works, in the sense that there are other viruses that show up in different parts of almost any survey I think that's gone on this way. There is one possibility, one way out of this hypothesis or to support it, and this would be for Brian with his evolutionary genetic background, but if you look within those species, so we kind of categorize things as Cashmere bee virus or the chalk root fungus, but if you look within those species, you do start to see signs that particular ones might actually be, the strains within species, especially the viruses, might actually be acting as a sort of sweep through a population tied to disease. The pipeline for this, in this case, was it's very subtle in this case, but these are just sort of nucleotide divergences across strains of viruses that we've sequenced out of these. And if you look at these CCD plus bees and CCD minus ones for one virus species, IABV, this yellow bar that's quite a bit shrunken down, and even the green bar to some extent, these are the third position nucleotide variants within these sequence lineups. And it's basically suggesting that irrespective of selection for maybe an extra virulent strain, that strain is homogeneous. There was something in those populations that was, the virus diversity was less, as it were, than it was in the other sample population. So we think that's a sign that maybe particular, particular strains or particular variants are causing disease. Yet to be proven in any of these cases, one needs to really go back and do what the plant people do or other commodities, where you inoculate with the different strains and really prove that some are worse than others. So that's all I'd like to say about the survey work. The bees are actually poor patients for this sort of work because many of them have left our planet in those colonies because of the decline. But it's also very hard to sample the whole superorganism of the colony to get a disease, right? We can do 50 bees, which we thought was really exciting if you do that many, but that's still, of course, a small, small fraction of the colony, and we're probably missing things because of just the difficulty of sampling. And we do think there might be signs of a strain times disease covariance. Another neat result that came with this, and again, this is now dozens and dozens of people sort lasered in, the laser-like focus on B disease, were some longitudinal studies where people looked at colony declines at actually marking individual bees, sort of anticipating doomsday for those colonies. And in this neat study by Benjamin Denat, what it showed, again, a little bit subtle on the graph, but the colonies that ended up failing at the end of the winter had some bees that lived all the way through to the colony just gave up the ghost and died. And where the mortality was in kind of middle-aged bees, you know, 30, 40, 50 days out from when they did be closed as adults. And so there's something, whatever it's doing, there's something affecting middle-aged kind of bees that we have to figure out what's going on. As with the survey studies, though, it's sort of we get the result and then we have to scratch our heads and go back to wonder what's going on with the mechanisms there. And here's another favorite quote that the beekeepers were giving us grief for. I don't know if we can hear it, but the quote is, excuse me, but did the word think actually come out of your mouth? Because we're actually doing a lot of work, a whole lot of work, and at the end we have to, you know, I don't think there was a lot of time sitting back on our heels and wondering what it all meant and how to move forward. And I think after the first kind of mania for colony collapse disorder, people did move on to plan B, which was to think about these syndromes and what's going on, but also to design experiments that will rationally test hypotheses. And so I just want to cover four angles that way, four avenues for looking at bee health that are maybe not inclusive. You know, I don't have pesticides up there. I don't have some really nice insights into bee nutrition, things like that. But I just wanted to say these are I think four manageable tasks that we've been engaged with to try to sort out meaning for why the colonies have failed, but also more importantly to see if we can separate out those factors. So the first one is the sort of the toxic couples. So this idea that pesticides by themselves are clearly not in and of themselves. I'd say most of the time it's true, not causing colonies to vanish from entire apiaries. They're having an impact on colonies, but if it were the case that a single chemical was always causing bee declines, I truly think we would have seen it by now. I don't think there's a doubt that we would have made that connection. Nevertheless, there is this opportunity or possibility that certain abiotic exposures to pesticides couple with certain pathogens and parasites. And there's some very nice experimental work with, in this case, fipronil and Osema, and then in another study with imidacloprid and Osema, some sort of idea that those two together have a non-additive or worse than additive effect on bee health. And that's a really fruitful avenue that people are looking at. The other way is to also approach it from the bee health standpoint and say, well, certainly, you know, it's terrible news that 30% of bees are declining to the point of empty boxes, but a good fraction of bees and even a good fraction of populations are staying healthy. And so trying to understand what beekeepers can do and what we can do scientifically to find out to simply improve management of those bees and to avert some of those losses. And this is the one sort of schematic for thinking about that, and that's exploiting, and this isn't unique. There's many avenues of people looking at different honeybee defenses by which the bees themselves, when faced with these dire threats, can mount defenses, and we can actually help to improve those. Certainly immunity by the individual bees in the middle once they're infected is important. Hygienic traits, abilities to keep the hive as free of disease as possible. And then finally, there's a really interesting undercurrent right now, looking at the hive environment and the indoor biologists call the whole genome, which is not the genome of the bee itself, not the genome of a virus or of a varroa mite, but the whole of that, and trying to understand with these interactions with the microbes in the hive, which ones are benefiting bee health and which ones are negative on bee health. And so that avenue has really made great leaps in the last 7 or so years. In part from importing talent, we have Nancy Moran, who's a professor now at Texas, has devoted a lot of her energy to this and really changed the outlook for it by bringing her skills of microbial genomics into it. We also have better experimentation, I think, now. So we have, historically, we've grown, I think, very good at inoculating bees with the bad bacteria that they might face, viruses, and the parasites like mice. Now we have really good techniques, I think, for inoculating bees with the whole of their bacterial complements or their microbial complements, and then following those with good tools. I'm going to talk about two experiments that we've done, and these really were serendipitous. They were from conversations with Nancy and getting cultures of bacteria that looked promising. One was run by Ryan Schwartz in the lab. This was, I do some stuff in the field, but this is probably the most biological stuff we've been doing the last couple of years, which is to rear newly emerged bees in these sterile plastic cups and do good and bad things to them. And what we're doing here is to inoculate them with one of the seven or eight predominant gut bacteria that bees carry, inoculate them with that one, and then see how they fend off different diseases. And there's a history of this in other insect studies where when they have these good bacteria in their guts, by, in some cases, mysterious means, they're able to fend off other bad parasites and pathogens. This is with microbiota. It's actually Crithidia there. It's now, we've recently renamed this trypanosomatid parasite of bees, Lathmaria. It's a common gut parasite of honeybees. And in this case, when you challenge bees with Lathmaria, the trypanosome, it grows less well when they also have one of these seven or eight bacteria, and we think it's additive with the other bacteria. So this bacterial complement somehow provides a buffer against a gut parasite. And this one kind of made sense because the bacteria actually coat the parts of the gut wall, especially in the ileum. This species coats the ileum in just the place that these trypanosomes start to make their adhesion and entry into the system. So it kind of made sense. Not a cure-all for that disease by any means, but it actually has helped the diseases reduced by having these bacteria. A more exciting project was actually done by an undergraduate student, Juliana Berga, and this one started, and I don't have the all of the data here, I'm sorry to say, but she's working to write this up soon. It started from a correlational study where we actually found virus loads were lower in bees that had certain levels of these gut bacteria. And there's a history of that in fruit flies. There's a virus disease that's reduced by having endogenous bacteria. Yeah, well, forget about the gut parasites that are in the gut, like Nosema and the trypanosome. Let's see if it does things against viruses. And we did this project where we actually, it was sort of a semi-field project. We inoculated bees with pure culture of the bacteria, and then we actually fed them. We didn't inject them with virus in this case. We would feed them virus and put them out into hives for a couple weeks. So this is the setting for virus growth, and we would measure viral growth with and without a pre-inoculation of this bacterium and go through it with a vacuum and basically snarf up every single painted bee from those colonies. So we get that, and we get pretty good return from the bees. We didn't see a difference in mortality, but we saw a significant difference in viral load. So bees, given these quote-unquote good bacteria at the start, had lower virus loads at the end. And this, as you can imagine, is not a direct interaction, right? The bacteria never eats the virus. The virus is in intracellular, and it moves into the system. And the bacterium, we think what's going on is it's triggering an immune response that then helps with viral resistance. And there's a neat word now, actually, some beekeeper work in Canada trying to test adult bee probiotics against these sorts of diseases. And that's highlighted here. And this is actually Googled from this morning. So if you can buy, these are human, of course, bacteria, but you can buy them at Walmart and Office Depot. So I think there is an avenue there to maybe at least ensure that whether it's packaged bees or small isolates of beehives or even hives themselves, that might not have picked up those bacteria to ensure they have the right complement of bacteria seems like a good question. The other corollary to that, and there's again Nancy's group did a neat study recently, is that perhaps antibiotic use, long-term sort of maybe prophylactic antibiotic use, does seem to impact these, and it could change those bacterial communities as it does in other agricultural systems. And we don't know the impacts of that on beef health, so there may be another avenue for using this bacteria only when properly prescribed. And very briefly, I want to mention a study about another interaction that I think is also going to reach a point of bee management solutions, and it's been posited for a while, but now there's really clear evidence that bees, given good nutrition, these are honeybees given an extra pollen supplement, or native pollen, even better, actually tend to reduce their virus loads. My take on this is they might actually be then favoring a healthy growth of these bacteria, and that's what drives the viral reduction. But it could simply be that the physiologically fit bees are able to keep down viruses. So it's again a way that intuitive for the beekeepers that good nutrition can't be bad for bees, of course, and it's good for bees, but it may also be something that could be prescribed as there's a risk for virus levels, not just when there's a need to build up bee numbers or to help the beehive. So I think that's been really exciting work in it, and it remains to be seen how this works, if it's something about the again, the physiology of the bees or just the way it works. Okay, so now, and actually for the rest of the talk, I'm going to focus on the number one target of many of the controls or many of the worries that there were for bee health, and also a focus for our group right now, which is the varroa mite. And this is a story that continues to get worse and worse. Varroa mites are now in most of the island populations of honeybees. They're traveling with us humans accidentally throughout. They're not yet, but imminently will be in Australia, and that'll be the last kind of major chunk of land that doesn't have this as an impact on honeybees. And wherever they go, they lead to increased chemical use to protect the bees from the mites, and generally poor fates for the honeybees where they meet up, especially when they newly arrive in a population and those bees might not have had prior experience or prior resistance to these mites. So they're huge threat to beekeeping, and they're not going away. Two avenues that seem to work for this are to look at breeding bees that are resistant. This is a very early, a 1992 study that successfully did that, which is promising, so you can actually get a bee. European honeybees have not been exposed to Varroa, now Varroa destructor, for a very, very long time, thousands, millions, maybe of years. So there is a sense that they're, as Mia actually pointed out this morning from, I think, Rittner's very earlier claims, they're like, they don't have it in them to resist this mite because it's so new and so different from other parasites they've met. Counter to that, almost anywhere people have tried, they've found ways to increase resistance to this mite. Whether it's by the development of the bees, the change in the colony life history, reducing brood levels at certain times, or hygienic behaviors. And so the exciting part is that these traits are in the bees, and there are people who are relaxing sort of the other controls for the mites, the parasitic mites, such that some of these traits we think are coming into the population. I did want to show one success story by another mostly indoor biologist, Greg Hunt at Purdue University, but Greg has also a very good ability to work with breeding groups, of honeybee breeding groups, and as part of this, it's sort of Heartland Queen Breeders Society. They started selecting just a few years ago for traits in those bees, behavioral traits that would limit the impacts of varroa mites. And they call them mite biters or ankle biters. And the definitive trait is many people in both determining whether to treat chemically for mites and also looking at resistance traits will count the number of mites in the hive, mostly on the bottom of the hive where they fall more or less out of the system. They did something, which again has been done, but they looked specifically at those mites and tried to determine which mites were sort of bee handled as they died. So which mites were put out of the system by some effect of the bees, probably biting the legs off or nipping at them to pull them off their sister bees. And so they screened them with a metric of mite damage, not so much the mite numbers, mite fall and such, but they actually measured the damage to those mites and determined breeding stock that had more damage than average or more than the rest of the population. And the truly amazing thing, and I'm now convinced that any sort of resistance trait, even in honeybees that haven't been exposed to a certain threat for a long time, any of these traits are, while the genetics are complex, there are many genes involved, there are continuous traits, any of them can be pushed into the population. What this study found was striking is there seemed to be no end. They were able to get over a threshold after a couple of years where they could push this up to 40 or 50% of the mites in this colony, these couple breeding colonies, that had that trait that were, or 50% of the colonies showed mites that had been ravaged by the bees in the colony. So the bees had bitten their legs off and knocked them down. So it's a good trait that beekeepers can use, and maybe more encouragingly from the genetic standpoint, it's one that's so highly heritable and perhaps dominant in a sense genetically that the returns on those efforts are really high. Like they were able to bring their bees up to a high rate. They're now working, as with any such project, to see if that really survives the test of time, if they can take those resistant vines, put them back in the field and get better survival. But it truly looks promising. I actually have picked this one. I think most of you have probably seen something like this. But this is the sort of trait that Craig's group was measuring. It takes a little longer. If you look at the bees up here, this picture, one of them here has this big frisbee-sized mite on her body. And this bee here is just going like crazy trying to find that mite. She can smell it, she can sense it perhaps, and she's trying to hit the mite that's on her nest mate. And in these breeding stocks, they're not just going after that mite and, seeing if they can knock it off. They're pulling it off and chewing it to bits. So it's just a really cool kind of extension of hygienic behavior by bees that, again, could be exploited as a breeding kit a little bit better. Okay, sorry. Another avenue for this and one that Judy Chen and myself in Maryland are really keen on is built on the fact that the mites themselves are, blood-sucking parasites, but what they do, as with the malaria mosquito, as with many of the plant-sucking bugs, is they transmit viruses, they transmit disease to their host, to the host that the mite's feeding on. And we started a project with one bee breeder, and we're actually trying it more broadly now, to look at their survival, the stock that survives really terrible mite levels. So mites that are physically on the bees, as in the bee on the right, that's a mite on her back, and nevertheless, they're not yet out of business. So somehow those bees are surviving these threats of mites. And one viable option is that the bees tolerate these mites. They eat a little extra to survive the blood loss. They somehow make it through. But their trait, their strength is really in tolerating or in resisting the viruses that the mites are actually injecting into the bodies. And this looks promising in this particular population. On the left side are levels of deformed wing virus that we know is transmitted by mites. And sure enough, bees that were in a susceptible population tended to just harbor higher virus levels for that virus. What was more interesting, the virus in the middle isn't transmitted by Borrelia, it's black queen cell virus, and it too was higher in these susceptible populations than the resistant ones. So we thought, well, this is great. This is a case where there might well be a generic virus resistance that can be added to the mite resistance if and when that exists to make them hardier bees. So we did a study with this bee breeder whereby they sent home sections of developing bees from what they termed six resistant and six susceptible lines from their populations. We didn't have enough mites really to do this quantitatively. It's a challenge to it. And two, we kind of wanted to throw the mites out of the equation. So we did this by injection. We injected pupal bees with a virus soup, a soup of viruses, or just with a saline buffer solution. And these are the results. And they're not, you know, drop dead pretty, but they, I think they're showing something going on physically within these bees. And this is, the bee are actually very scientifically produced bad bees and good bees, which doesn't matter so much because the bee breeder, in this case, their prediction of which bees would be more resistant to viruses versus less didn't hold up so well. And I'll show you why. There's, this is what you might expect from a bad bee line. Number of bees, the blue dots are for control bees given the saline. The reds are the ones that were given this soup of viruses. And the virus levels went through the roof. There's a quantitative estimate of viruses. So they went up much higher than those. And here as well. Here's one where they had some of the bees certainly carry virus. This is a very frequent virus in populations. But it didn't go up at all, even though we gave them this pretty hefty dose of inoculant viruses. So on average, that pollinator is going to change the virus titer with the dose. Here's another one where it went up. Here's another one where it's more diversity, but it didn't change again. And we see that in the good isolates or strains as well. Again, here's one where there's virus present, but it didn't get any worse, as it were, when we fed them. And these are doses that we know generally cause an abundance of virus growth in the bees. It's going right into their hemolymph, lots of viral copies, and it should have made them very sick, and in some cases it didn't. One way to look at that, to look at the mechanism behind that, is to look at how the bees react to this inoculum. And these are just, if you've seen RNA sequencing plots or even for microarrays, these are, in this case, genes or parts of genes upregulated with among resistant bees and then downregulated or actually upregulated in the susceptible bees, however view you want to take of it. What's interesting here, and sort of sobering for making this something that maybe a bee breeder could use, is that we didn't see a lot of change between the bees when we gave them the saline. The real meaty stuff is down here. These are actually just scales. So basically there's a lot going on between these two classes of bees when you give them the actual virus challenge, which fits again with the fact that they're differently able to deal with these viruses. But and we think it's offering some insights into how they're reacting to a virus load. Another way of looking at it, don't worry so much about the labels on these, but just this is a categorizing the genes that are changing expression. Compare that to here. These are genes changing in expression when bees were given the actual true virus, the direct virus inoculum. It's really hard to read. There's phagocytosis, dsRNA transport, some of metabolism, wound healing, autophagic cell death. There's a whole bunch of meaty gene families or processes in there that are different between the resistant and susceptible bees. So we think this approach is finding some of that resistance. There have been other efforts too to find responses to disease that I think we can all start comparing them together and see what's consistent. And then logistically, it also means that you don't get this sort of view of the bee bodies when you use saline or a sort of surrogate for a challenge. You have to use the actual virus, which is kind of a pain for proposing this as something a beekeeper would use, but they have to actually keep these virus inoculums. Okay. underneath it then. So we're struggling with that, how to actually enact this as maybe a screening technique. Because even within one lab at one time, getting a soup of virus that you can use this week versus next week is a challenge because they're inhumant and messy, and we don't have a sort of cell culture means of keeping viruses alive or isolating them. But we're hoping that there's a way to use, those responses are consistent enough that we'll be able to use that as a way to screen different lines of these. These are maybe more details on the actual changes that we see in those bees. And the punchline here is that the resistant bees are basically holding the line on a lot of their processes, metabolism. It's just kind of intuitive that they're basically not, the virus is not changing the bee physiology as much as it would otherwise. And it's probably, these viruses have to get in, they have to take the ribosomes, the actual protein making machinery of their host, and these bees seem to be stopping some of those inroads. It's a work in progress. Certainly can't think about that much about immunity towards viruses. So we're taking these candidate genes and still debating and wondering what they mean for a breeding trait, for an actual trait that might actually be put into a major piece. Now I'm going to talk about sort of even more gene-based approaches to bee health and the ability. We have a honeybee genome that's well vetted now. Lots of we know what we can infer, at least from other species, what a lot of the proteins do. We also now have resources for really anything that's bad that bees eat or get eaten by. So we have the viruses and the parasites, fungi and bacteria, and there should be a way to exploit information on those other partners of the bees to control them, to reduce them, and whether it's a chemical way or a way that simply looks at the cues that different parasites use, like the hive beetle and mites use to find their bee hosts. We're hoping that many people are banking on the fact that we can use the genetic information from those parasites to actually then interpret. One such project is the Varroa Mite Genome Project, and that's in full swing still. It's a collaborative project across many different labs and institutes. Started unglamorously by pooling a bunch of mites from a single colony, and as Don is doing there, mashing them up to get their DNA. And the really hard work on this, and the biology part of it, and again, requiring lots of people with different insights and backgrounds, is to know how to translate those gene predictions or gene products into something biological for the mite. The three focus groups are development of the mites, thwarting development, finding out how they cue into the larvae just at the right time, just before the cells are capped for the bees, and then finally how they find each other in the dark down there in the cells. This is just one summary of, and these are all public now. We have NCBI has the mite protein sets and sequences available. But we're trying now to annotate that, to figure out which are especially tempting candidates for understanding my biology or even my control. Dozens of the candidates are dominantly posed in Drosophila, and those are the perfect candidates for a sort of control method because if you can reduce those proteins by even a fraction, they should have some impact on fitness. Another sort of low-hanging fruit from this was identifying some microbes tied to the varroas and the varroa mites that we sequenced actually, in this case one on the right, a bacterium that doesn't seem to show up as one of the natural ones in honeybees, but it's in varroa. And on the top, a DNA virus that again, is more often in mites than in bees. So we're maybe some exploring of how to exploit those in the mites. Just to highlight, if those of you who are insects, or my physiologists, some really neat work by a folks like Anna Cabrera on understanding mite development. This is one of, I think, four papers that she put out in a couple of years, showing taking the candidates from the genome, but then really showing how they change development, and again, how they might be used as a a way to understand this mite reproduction in this case, or how mites find their bee hosts. And this is really exciting because it hasn't been done with burrow mites before, and I think it would, it could lead to an insight into how to slow their development. Another technique that's been, now it seems like it's not such a recent technique, it's been bouncing around for, well, in the first case, since about 22, 23 years, is RNA interference, a means by which double-stranded RNAs in particular can inhibit the gene expression or the transcript abundance of their matches in an organism. And it works in mice. So if you put in a copy of, like a short copy of a gene sequence from the burrow mite in a double-stranded molecule, that copy will lead to a process by which that gene will be kept silent. It won't be able to express its transcript and thereby its protein. So this is working mechanistically in mites. There's a nice study from the UK showing a knockdown of not the first candidate gene to remove mites, but at least a good proof of principle. There's, of course, industrial interest in this, or now commercial interest, and it looks promising. It's not something you're going to see on the shelf, unfortunately, because I understand that just the production is still rather expensive. but there is a very good chance that there could be a specific control for mites. Here's one statistic, again, sort of such as the nature of science, it's not drop dead for the mites, but it shows that there is a quantitative decrease in mite levels. That's the varroa per bees, which is a common metric of how many mites are in hives. And by using no chemicals, no organophosphates or chemicals, they were able to knock down levels of the mites at the hive level by feeding them this product. So hopefully, I mean, I keep saying hopefully the last few years, but I think at some point this will become a viable strategy for reducing mites as a disease threat. Okay, so I'm going to end there. Just wanted to acknowledge the group in Belgium. We have five different laboratories there. Myself, Judy Chen, Jeff Pettis, and now Stephen Cook, who's a toxicologist looking at many of these interactive effects with pesticides, and Miguel Corona, who's a new scientist looking at bee nutrition. So we're all trying to divvy up the myriad ways that bees get healthy and get sick. My lab is especially managed by Don Lopez, who's a technician in the USDA and helps run all these tough experiments. Although this is my favorite part of the lab, is actually feeding the bees for these experiments. So I get to actually feed them, but she does everything else. So I'm going to stop there and be happy to take questions. He's doing a process now where he's sending out queens, or the Harvard breeders, they're sending them out for field bedding exactly like that. And the beekeeper fills out a detailed report on, do you like the bees? Do they come out during the day when they should? Do they just stay inside and fight each other? So I think those sorts of questions are important. And the good part about it is this wasn't a really pre-selected stock. It had some BSH, but I think the trait is showing up. People could tailor this trait to bees bred in Northern California, or to that. As with most of these traits, they're kind of lurking under the surface, and it's just a matter of, this is the most heritable one that I've ever seen. I mean, we tried it with some mean traits, and they kind of peter out at 30% after a lot of work. And this one seems to be shooting up very quickly, which is promising. And it might mean that it could be, because of that, it could be decoupled from other less desirable things. Yeah.
Just a question about the breeding. So you mentioned a paper that was published in 1992, which is like ancient history for you type of folks. And what's the status on Bee Breeding? I'm just curious. I mean, are we, so you know, you see enormous responses, and bees that are widely used in North America now highly resistant to varroa, and I just don't know it, or are they just not making their way out, or what's the update on that?
That's a good question. I mean, sometimes starting with any breeding solution, the pain by the other means has to be really high of not using chemicals, say. I mean, of using chemicals. So I think in most cases, the chemical controls of mites have succeeded enough that beekeepers haven't been willing to spend double for a queen that's carefully bred for the resistance. But that's tilting a bit. They're especially for, some of the bigger breeders now are able to market those resistant bees, but I think it's an economic thing in a sense. You're right, the traits have been recognized for a while. They're hard to maintain in a population in an open mating species like a honeybee, in a sense, and so it's extra cost to kind of maintain and push them in, and that the market hasn't embraced that cost.
So it is constant relaxation following the loss of
exactly,
there's
yeah.
No,
yeah.
There's no retention of that.
I think overall in Europe and the U.S., and let alone Brazil, where they don't treat the chemicals, resistance has risen. It's still not at the point where it's economically enough that people can
just
afford to not treat. What's that?
Just in the interest in paying for it, it's cheaper.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, but I don't know. It could be a top-down thing where they limit other controls, but that would be very painful for beekeepers. They can't. The hope is with genetic tools, possibly if one avenue, that trait would be stable enough that it could be more economical to mass produce those queens. So if we get buy-in, somebody gets buy-in to the big queen breeders in Georgia or even California, and they can keep the trait in there without losing tons of money doing that, they'll do it. You're right, it's been 20 some years and it hasn't happened yet, so forces against it, just mainly the genetics are just messy with it. It's not like corn where you can save the seeds forever and not out there, they're not sexual at all. Bees are very sexual and very prolific as queens, so they go out and mate whoever they want.
But they don't, they don't go out and mate once they're done with that.
So if you're marketing, the breeders usually have a closed population and a closed gene pool. You're right, they could sell queens that are ready to go. It's a little bit.
I have a question about the micro study that you talked about at the beginning. And where do you think those microbes are coming from? Are they coming from within the hive? Are they inoculating the bees and the bees right away? Are they picking them up outside of the hive? And what do you think the dynamics of that are? Is it, if they're coming from within the hive, is that community able to build up and then outcompete any potential bad microbes that might be coming
from? Yeah, that's a good question. So they come from nurse bees, it seems, regurgitating nurse bees. So mechanistically, they are fed. A newly emerged bee gets most of the complement within 2 days, I think it's an answer. So if you put 20 really sterile bees in a plastic cup and drop in one nurse bee, they'll pick them up within a couple of days. There's pretty good transmission within the hive. And then because of the reproduction, and they reproduce by swarms, they go with reproductive units too. I think there must be a filling in from flowers at some point, defecating on flowers, but I think most of it is handled by lots of transmission in the hive. However, you do get hives that don't have several of them, and so how they would recapture that one species seems like a challenge. Do they have to wait till properly inoculated hive pollinates the flowers they're visiting, or do they live without it for a long time? We don't know. It's the same with the human microbiome stuff. Like, there are people with different communities of bacteria. And it's hard to explain to us how they
question because it's a question that I'm struggling with in my own work. So you presented some the survey work at the outset, right, where you have these correlations between presence of different viruses and what you see as a sick or a healthy colony. Yeah. And I'm wondering how you deal with the interpretational challenges of that. So which way is the direction of causality? You know, yeah. Are the sick colonies having more virus because they're sick and so their immune system is depressed, or are those viruses actually making them sick? So
yeah,
how do you deal with that?
I mean, historically, as a community, we usually overstated the virus role and don't prove it otherwise, which usually takes 6 months or so to prove that it couldn't explain every case of illness. But there are, there are very good studies, longitudinal studies with these viruses that show. And Benjamin's study, the overwintering one, I didn't talk about the backstory there, but he was measuring SEMA virus levels, all sorts of diseases, and there are really pretty tight correlations with risk ratios or increased risk of decline. So it's not just snapshots that aren't repeatable, which as it feels like us, maybe we've done a lot of them, or why didn't that work this time? But there are cases where people have shown over time a predictive value of them, where you can do it before the class, and so they're clearly involved with them. It's just that for whatever reason, the same ones might be involved in one population and not in another. Just probably the fate of epidemics.
So basically, throughout the second part of your talk, you referred a number of times to different effects, and you sort of forced to say, from the perspective of a lab-based approach, this should make a difference. Like this, we see a change in mites, and so you're hopeful that this will make a difference. And so I wondered if you, as someone who's like part of these big teams, do you have someone in that team who is a modeler that is looking, say, at the dynamics of mite populations on colonies, so that you could actually look at this? So if you said, okay, well, we can have this hygienic behavior, or we can knock down resistance by X percent, a demographer or a population modeler would then be able to say that the trajectory of the mite population within that hive now ought to be negative, and the hive ought to be able to sustain itself. And so rather than saying, we hope in all of our disjoint labs that these various really elegant molecular techniques, it just seems like something in those big groups ought to.
I think there are, I've not done any integral part of such a big group. There are modelers doing really nice work. It's actually with mites, you don't need to have negative population growth. You need to keep them, decrease the curve by 30%, and the viruses don't become part and parcel of that. So it's really looking at, in March, looking at predicting what the mite load would be like in September when they're generally high, generally passing lots of disease around. And so there are people showing that, yeah, you can ding that at the start by 30%, something like that, the net mite loads will be tenfold less, and that's probably sustainable. So there is, that approach is going on. So we go by the assumption that even our incremental decrease of mite loads will affect colony health. Elena might be able to say specific models that are favored now, but they're having good efforts, growth models basically, to do that.
Okay, I'm told that at 1 o'clock the room turns into a conference, so if you want to continue your conversation with Janice, he'll be outside the hall for a few minutes, and I'd like to thank Steve Adler for